Hello, everybody, and welcome aboard USS The Sullivans, or should I say welcome alongside USS The Sullivans, because that's where we're going to be walking for the next couple of minutes. Some of you may recall back in April 2022, when I was doing my first tour of the US and its various museum ships, I was supposed to do quite an extensive bit with Ryan aboard USS New Jersey. However, on the day that we were there, news came in that poor old Sullivan's here had sunk at its moorings, so, well, that was a little bit of a distraction. And this footage comes from June 2022, shortly after she was brought back up. And again, some of you may have seen the interview that I did at the time with the museum's curator. But for those of you who perhaps haven't kept up with all of that, but know that the Sullivan sank and might want to know why, very simply put, this was not the fault of the museum. You know, they didn't let her just rust through and let her bottom fall out and sink into the muck. What happened was something called a seiche, or possibly seiche. I'm not entirely sure how that's actually pronounced, but it's spelled S-E-I-C-H-E. Now, we're not doing a geography video, but very briefly, a seiche or seiche or whatever it is. It's basically a combination of wave harmonics, and in the case of the Great Lake that Buffalo is just at one end of, also the wind, which happens to run normally in roughly the same direction as the lake. And this can cause what would be seen in a normal environment out at sea as a storm surge. So all the water piles up at one end of the lake and then it eventually goes away again. And this is a reasonably common phenomena. It's known that the water levels can change by as much as 16 feet. Now, that didn't quite happen in this particular case, but there was still a rise of at least 5 or 6 feet, possibly a little bit more. But it happened overnight, and what this meant was that poor old the Sullivans here, along with obviously USS Little Rock you can see in the background, and the other vessels here in Buffalo were essentially picked up by a rising tide in an area that shouldn't have tides. And then as it went out again, it dumped everything back down. But of course, everything had shifted slightly. Now, fortunately for Little Rock and the other ships in the area, they came down roughly in the same place that they should have done. But for the Sullivans, she came down on some of her more solid moorings. You can see some of the pads and stuff there to her right, although those weren't what she landed on. But she landed on some mooring piles, and it was those that punched through her hull, which, yeah, there ain't an awful lot you can do about that. I mean, generally, but especially when you're a destroyer without all that much in the way of hull thickness to begin with. And unsurprisingly, with a hole or two punched in her side, she filled up with water and rolled over slightly, but fortunately, because she is after all moored in relatively shallow water, while she did roll over and sink, it wasn't fully over, it was about 30 degrees, and she wasn't fully submerged either. So once they'd figured out what had happened, it was a case of finding the holes, making sure they were patched, at least temporarily, and then pumping everything out. Now, the Sullivans is due for an extensive dry dock and refit at some point in the near future as of the time of release of this video, but at the time that I took the following video, she was only just out of the water and they'd begun clearing up the engine room and other flooded areas. But although the ship was closed to the public at the time other than as a gangway to get aboard the Little Rock, the crew and curator of the Sullivans were kind enough to let the shipshape crew, including, of course, me, aboard her, and I did what would, as it turned out, become the standard format of my tours of these museum ships, i.e. looking at the stuff above the main deck level to try and encourage people to go and see, well, the stuff I've seen, the stuff I've not shown you, and the stuff below decks as well. And the reason the video is coming out right now is because, of course, it is towards the end of April, so Buffalo Naval Park should be open for visitors by the time you see this video, which means, obviously, I'm encouraging you to go and have a look around. Maybe tell them that Drac sent you. But one thing which I will note in advance, and which you might have already noticed in terms of picture quality, is that it was an incredibly bright day. That whole month seemed to have some incredibly bright sunshine, which you probably saw in the video I did aboard HMCS Sackville, which was actually only a few days after this one. And, well, let's just say some cameras coped with the glare a little bit better than others. So as you can see, in still shots, fine. In little DJI handheld, for some reason, coped with it fine. But the cameras with the larger lenses, unfortunately, tended to get a little bit washed out by the sheer glare. Now, I have attempted to correct for contrast and brightness as best I can, but if you're wondering why the video that follows might look a little bit odd, and the walk around as well, basically that's why. I didn't think to stick an ND filter on the lens of my DSLR, and indeed I don't even have one, even if I had thought of it, but there you go. So, with all that said, enjoy the tour of the recently refloated USS The Sullivans, and maybe check out the interview with the curator Shane down in the video description as well afterwards. Thanks very much.
All right, welcome aboard USS The Sullivans. This is the first Fletcher class Detroit I've actually managed to get on board. I've seen quite a few, but first one physically aboard, so good place to start. We are, of course, on the fantail at the stern with the two aftmost 5-inch guns, and again, a new experience for me, because this is, of course, the single 5-inch gun. All the battleships that have been preserved have the twin version, so very different mounting, very different shape, obviously only a single weapon. And, of course, the Sullivans is not entirely in its World War II configuration. We'll see that a bit more as we go around the ship. But the two aft guns are, as near as they can be, pretty much what you would have found when you were actually aboard, if you were aboard the ship in 1943, 1944, 1945, which is, of course, the years that she was in service. So you might be able to see behind me, you've got the second gun of the aft two there, the super firing one, and then above, that's one of the later editions. That's the one of the twin 3-inch anti-aircraft gun, which is a product of the 1950s. So let's go a bit further forward. So here's something that you see quite often in films of the period, but these days you don't actually see very often on the museum ships. Most museum ships will have the Bofors, which we'll see a little bit later on as well, but not too many will actually retain the Oerlikons. USS Alabama famously has a lot of them, including some that have been converted to sort of semi-live firing. But this one is as you might be able to work out, a twin mount. There are two 60-round ammunition drums and a basic shield, which will have some effect, I suppose. And you can see why these were so popular, why they were so easy to position, because, of course, the ship was not designed to carry these when she was originally... Well, Sullivan's was carrying them when she was commissioned, but the Fletcher class as a whole was not designed to carry these when they were originally conceived. But you can't see because of perspective of the camera, but just down on the deck, there's a simple mounting, and it's literally just sitting there. It's got some bolt holes, can weld it in place if you want as well, but there's no requirement for anything going through the deck to keep this thing on. And of course, it makes a fairly good close-in weapon system, which is for air defense in World War II for the beginning and middle part. Towards the end, it is beginning to struggle a bit, which is why it gets replaced with a 40mm and the 3-inch later on. Not because of any particular loss of lethality. These things are actually quite, as I said, easy and relatively lightweight to install. The main problem that comes with them is that you need reasonable numbers of people to actually man and maintain them. And when you have so many, that number of men increases exponentially. Whereas if you compare the weight and crewing requirements of, let's say, a quad 40mm, which you might use to replace two or three of these mountings, then although that quad 40 might even weigh more than two or three of these mountings, once you take into account the men that you're saving, there is actually a weight saving involved, plus obviously the 40mm outranges the 20, and that's the major problem. It's not that the 20mm can't kill aircraft, it's that it's now getting to a point where it can't kill aircraft within the aircraft's weapon release range, that's all it can do. So an aircraft that's dropping a bomb or dropping a torpedo, sure, the 20mm can kill it, but that aircraft will have dropped its own weapon first, which means that if that aircraft's done its job properly and the anti-aircraft crew do their job properly, it's probably a mutual kill, which isn't particularly brilliant. You want to be able to hit the enemy before they release their weapons, and for that the 40 mil is becoming gradually better and better, although, to be fair, again, even by the end of the war, the 40 mil is beginning to run out of that kind of effectiveness, and you're ending up with the 3-inch replacing it shortly after the war in most cases. The reason that I don't know if you can hear that, someone's decided to sound off a horn. The reason the 20 mil it remains aboard ships is partly, well, it's available, and secondly, also once you're into the Pacific campaign, and there's a lot of kamikazes, obviously they have to come into physical contact with the ship, at which point the fact that a 20 mil might take a kamikaze down 100 yards off of the ship's bow is absolutely fine, because then it's still down. Basically, the existence of kamikazes prolongs the widespread use of the 20 mil aboard Allied warships for perhaps 6 months to a year longer than it probably would have otherwise. The other thing you can probably see while we're here, because of course we are on the Sullivans, is there is a line that runs about here where below it is slightly darker grey. This is basically as far up as the water got when the ship went over onto its starboard side a few months ago. So we're now about, let's say, 40% of the way along the ship. So we've come past the aft superstructure where there's the twin 3-inch now, and the fire control director will have a look at that in a bit, because we're still on the main part of the upper deck. And this is approximately the area where a Fletcher class would have had her two quintuple torpedo launchers. Now, unfortunately, because obviously the Sullivans was an active service vessel well after World War II, she doesn't have them anymore. So we're standing in roughly the area where they would have been. The camera would basically be looking over a quintuple torpedo tube if they still existed. But now this is just an open deck area. But what you can probably just see in the top right of your picture is that cluster of three tubes with black heads. Those are anti-submarine torpedo launchers, much lighter, smaller weapons than the Mark 15s that the Sullivans would have been carrying in World War II. And those are 1950s refits, obviously being smaller and lighter, they can be carried higher, keeping this area clear. And obviously during those refits, there were additional changes to the superstructure, which is why if you look at the profile of the Sullivans now, whereas if you look at the profile of the Sullivans back when she was in the Second World War, there are some rather striking visual differences in terms of her silhouette. But, you know, it is what it is. It's a good representation of what the US was doing to its destroyers during the early part of the Cold War to try and update them from what were effectively gun-based ships only to ships that were designed to deal with an ever-widening threat. Because, of course, remember, whilst the quintuple torpedo tubes that the Sullivans carried in World War II were perfectly fine for use against other surface ships, unless an enemy submarine was dumb enough to come to the surface and remain on the surface, they were useless against submarines. The only thing that the Sullivans had to deal with submarines, if that came down to it, was either depth charges off of the back rails or the Hedgehog launchers, which are further forward, maybe some depth charge launchers on the side, but that's really about it. Nothing that could home, nothing that was longer range than a ballistic arc just off of the ship. And these triple anti-submarine tubes, one set of launchers on each side, give her a much, much greater capability against the underwater threat. She still has four of her five-inch guns, because obviously you've got the amidships five-inch gun, that's also gone. And she has an anti-aircraft battery, obviously not quite as the same as what she had back when she was in what the Second World War, but with the twin 3-inch, which we'll see a bit later, perhaps you could argue a bit better. And of course the 5-inch are still dual purpose weapons as well. So I mentioned depth charges and what could be done to kill submarines with them, and this is one of the ways that you could do that. So as you can see, we have some drums here, and then we have a Mark 9 Mod 3 depth charge. Now, this is on what's called a Y-gun launcher. So they have Y-gun launchers and K-gun launchers. They're basically the same thing. They're side-mounted launchers to fire off depth charges. The only difference is in the configuration and how many charges they can fire. So the depth charge is placed on here. The launcher pings the depth charge off the side. And this is one of the earliest ways to give a ship a capability of engaging in some way that doesn't involve sailing over the contact and just chucking a depth charge off the back. So for one thing, obviously, the depth charge goes further away from the ship. So it can be set to a shorter fuse for shallower depths without endangering the ship itself. It means the ship doesn't have to run over the contact. And this is very important because whilst running over a suspected contact, then dropping a depth charge might be fine in World War One when you're working off of, well, visual sightings, maybe hydrophones. If you're in World War II with ASDIC, if you're in the Royal Navy, sonar, if you're in the US Navy, one of the big problems is if the sonar or ASDIC is up forward, once you run over that contact, you no longer have it on your contact, and then you've got to wait for the ship to pass over, then you drop your depth charge, then you've got to wait for the depth charge to sink and the fuse to set, and then it goes off. And in that time, a clever submarine captain can usually get out the way. Whereas the Y-gun and K-gun launchers don't give them as much opportunity. You can sail broadside past them and get the depth charge off a lot faster. But also, especially in the early period of their deployment, it actually means that submarine captains won't necessarily expect them to be coming. Because if you're a submarine captain and you think your opponent just has depth charge rails on the back, then you're going to wait for him to come over you, because then you think, right, that's the only time he can harm me. So if the destroyer that you are hunting or being hunted by charges forward and you hear it pass by you, you're going to think, okay, well, he's gone past me. I don't need to maneuver too much, because if any depth charges he drops off the back won't explode close enough to harm me, then one of these things fires, you hear the splash, and it's really too late to do anything at that point. So that's another part of the ship's anti-submarine measures. So this is more of a general shot. I don't even know if I'm actually going to be in this shot, but this is looking forward from around the area of where the quintuple torpedo launchers would have been. So you can see an array of original and modified features. You can see the ship's two funnels, you can see the tripod mast up there, and you can see the multiplicity of radars, which of course, some of which are World War II vintage, some of which are much later, from the 1950s refits. And of course, there's a couple of PA speakers here, just because, you know, you need to shout to sailors. And even though it's a destroyer, and you do get a definite impression this is very much a destroyer when you're up next to Little Rock next to us, which is basically this steel monolith overwhelming us, really, then, you can't shout at everybody on a destroyer from the bridge, and so the PA system is an incredibly useful thing to have. And there's someone out there who really thinks their horn is a really incredibly useful thing to have. I disagree. So here we are at the front end of the Sullivans, the business end, if you like. And once again, we have a pair of single 5-inch 38 gun mounts, one on top of the other in a super firing positions. Now, you might think, oh, well, what's the difference between this and what's after it? Well, not a tremendous amount, but it does help to show, you know, she's got four of her original five guns. And there are a few features here that you don't see on the aft guns. Like, for example, this hatch here has been opened, so if you needed to manually control the guns, you could do. And one little feature which I really do appreciate is there's even a tiny windscreen wiper there for sea spray, fog, ice, etc. And of course, since this is the forwardmost gun and we're only maybe 20 feet away from the bow, that is probably going to see a fair bit of use in the event that you actually have to open that hatch up at all. You can see further back up there you've got the bridge. You can see one of the Hedgehog launchers. The bridge, of course, also being slightly different to what it was in the Second World War. And you might be able to hear in the background there's some very angry starlings who don't like the fact we've intruded on their turf. But to give you some idea of where the ship is in comparison, so the stern of Little Rock and the stern of the Sullivans, they're not exactly equal, but they're fairly close. And here is, of course, the Little Rock in her glory. So as I say, we're right near the bow. This is the aft part of the forward superstructure of Little Rock. And as we come forward, then there is the bridge, or one part of the bridge of Little Rock. There's the Croaker, the submarine, in front of us. And there is the bow, where there are the two 6-inch gun turrets on the forward part of the Little Rock. So that gives you some idea of just how much larger the cruiser is than the destroyer. We're actually on pretty much the same level deck-wise here, but that's because I'm on the foremost part of the Sullivans, whereas that's just the main deck for the Little Rock. If you went to the bow of the Little Rock, you'd be higher still again. And of course, you can see there at the front of Little Rock, the very spiral spider type antenna array, which you also see a similar version of on the Iowas for communications purposes in a Cold War combat environment. But as you can probably just about see off to the right, effectively within a margin of maybe a few tens of feet, the Little Rock is as long as the Sullivans and the Croker put together. So yeah, just a little large. And obviously, if you've seen the video on USS Salem, if it's come out by this point, Little Rock is not a patch on the size of the Salem. So yeah, Salem's a big ship. And here, just behind the super firing forward 5-inch, is one of the two Hedgehog launchers on the Sullivans. The other one is just to the starboard. This is the port side one. And you're probably wondering, okay, this is what a Hedgehog launcher actually looks like. There's actually surprisingly few photos of these things in action. 7.2-inch charges, and these are launched obviously slightly forward port, slightly forward starboard. And like we were discussing with the depth charge launchers and the Y-gun projector, this gives the destroyer the best chance of destroying a submarine contact without having to give up its sonar contact, because, as I say, these can fire ahead. The only downside of these is you can probably tell they are somewhat smaller than a depth charge individually, so they have to be fired in a fairly wide pattern, because you really need a hit, ideally two or three, directly to deal with a sub. An indirect explosion of one of these probably isn't going to trouble a U-boat all that much, whereas even an indirect explosion from a depth charge really will trouble a submarine, as long as it's close enough. And yeah, in the tradition of the channel, picking up all things possible that could explode, there's a Hedgehog projectile, and you can see there one of the little spigot mortars that actually launches the thing. So let's put that thing back and continue on with our tour. And here we have another element of the ship's defences, although again, this was in these particular weapons were installed around the same time the triple torpedo launchers were installed. So not exactly a World War II configuration for the Sullivans, but she would have had some weapons like this on the ship. These are, of course, the 40mm Bofors guns, this time in a twin mount. Again, of course, not the most common of anti-aircraft mounts that you might find on a museum ship in the US these days. A lot of ships obviously have the quad. This one is a twin. It has a partner over the other side. Unfortunately, this one doesn't rotate, at least at the moment. But you can see you've got some nice big recoil springs here. And there is an ammunition locker behind, but you can't see that because the mount's in the way. And this is what you would rotate if you wanted to spin the mount left and right. The one on the other side is for up and down. And you've got the ammunition hopper tray there. And if the camera angle is allowing, you can actually see that there is a shell there, just so you can see just how that would work. So these positions are on the wings, just forward of the aft funnel, just aft of the fore funnel. And, you know, well, they're in still pretty good shape. A little bit of a lick of paint, but certainly not the worst shape ever. And right here is an intake for air intake for one of the boilers. And here is the thing that I was pointing out earlier down from the deck below. This is one of the two triple anti-submarine torpedo launchers. And what we have here, the training gear heaters and the actual full-on heater switches on and off. So that's obviously to warm the torpedo innards up, ready to make them ready for firing. So fairly simple, unlike the torpedo launchers of World War I and World War II, which are obviously much bigger, heavier things, where if you've got a multiple launch array, they come flat. These, because they're smaller and lighter, can come in this triple stack configuration, pyramid configuration, and you've got this end on your right, which is where you would reload them, which again you can do because you can carry, they're smaller, you can carry them. And so over at this end, so this is the left hand side for you viewers at home, there's a little label here, tells you what kind of torpedo launcher this is, but this is the breech end, so you'd have to open up this to reload the torpedo launchers, which you can do because smaller torpedo, and then you progress over to this end. There's just some basic stops, you pull those off so you can launch the torpedoes, and obviously the launch will be trained out over the side and fired off at whatever it was you wanted to kill. And over on this side, on the starboard side launcher, you can see they've actually opened up a reload case, so you can see what Mark 44 anti-submarine torpedo looks like, at least somewhat. And of course, because this is the Buffalo Naval Park, not just the USS Sullivan's, I don't know what it is about rotary engine trucks, but they seem to be quite common over here. Anyway, so you have a nice US Navy Cold War era jet up there on a rack, and then you have another one there, what appears to be a PT boat, a Huey, some missiles, and a tank. That's all part of it. And of course, as we've shown you earlier, the Little Rock and the sub. So here we are at a relatively high point on the Sullivan's. This did require a bit of climbing to get to. So we're actually positioned in, or on, I should say, the aft radar fire control tower, because this platform here, which is above the super firing 5-inch, is where, as you can see in front of me, the twin 3-inch automatic firing anti-aircraft fitting is placed. And the camera can't zoom out far enough while we're down on that platform, so we're up here instead. Now, as you can see, there are clusters of 3-inch shells either side there, on the left and the right. You can see the auto feed mechanism, which currently on both guns has a pair of shells loaded ready to go. You can see the spindles, they allow multiple shells to be loaded in from there. There are some ammunition boxes, which you can't see, just below the camera view, where you can get spare 3-inch shells, and there's also a feed mechanism which will feed 3-inch shells up from a magazine, feed them out onto the main deck, when they can then be passed up onto the deck that you can see where the gun is mounted, and then fed in as well, because this is important. This 3-inch twin mount can kick out an awful lot of firepower very quickly, so you're going to chew through all the shells you've got there on the mount, you're going to chew through all the shells you've got in the ready use lockers quite fast, at which point you're going to want some reloads, because if you're chewing through that much 3-inch ammo, that probably means there's a fairly serious threat incoming. So you have to depend on the crew to supply all that to you. You can also see from the way those rails that arc back from each mount are curved, just how high up these mounts can train. They are one of the most lethal dual-purpose mounts in existence in the late 1940s and early 1950s. The only downside to the 3-inch is that its individual shell firepower is not that great, so that's why you don't see ships with vast numbers of 3-inch as their main armament. They are still primarily an anti-aircraft gun, but they've climbed into the region where they can also be anti-surface weapons in a pinch, especially against smaller craft. And then, of course, you can see you've got the rail around the edge to make sure crew don't fall off. But it's a very complicated weapon. Compare that to a 1920s or 1930s 3-inch, which this is a direct derivation of, and the loading mechanisms and so forth are so much simpler. A 1920s or 1930s 3-inch mount, you could probably have got four of them in the same space as you've got this twin mount here, with a lot more room to spare. But, you know, times progress, times from on, that's how you get to where, well, where this ship was in the 50s and 60s, and then later on where we are today. And of course, we've already looked at these weapons, the triple torpedo tubes and the twin Bofors and so forth, but, well, let's just say even when the ship is reopened, this is not a view you're commonly going to get, if at all, as a regular visitor. So I thought, let's share that with you. It is quite a magnificent view, and you get an idea again of, you know, yes, this may be a destroyer, yes, this may be the smallest, if you like, line equivalent combatant vessel in the US Navy. It's, you know, the smallest type of ship you'd expect to see forward deployed in a major fleet to fight the enemy head to head in a major engagement. It's still not a small vessel. It can feel like that when you're down in some of the rooms below decks. And in comparison to Little Rock, which you can see looming here off to our port side, yes, she is smaller, but she's far from small. You know, she's bigger than in length, and maybe not quite so much in displacement, but certainly in overall length bow to stern as Victory. And HMS Victory, of course, being a first rate. And if you look to your left, you can see a wild Dr. Clark hunting his way down the length of the Little Rock. And if you're wondering, are there any remnants of stuff that was removed from the Sullivans during her various refits? Well, yep, here we are on one of the sections of the ship. So we're at the same level as the triple torpedo launchers, the twin Bofors, etc. And as you can see here, there is a ring mounting. This is all that's left of a weapon system that was once installed here. Now, for extra clues, we're just forward of the aft superstructure and radar, what's now a radar rangefinder, and we're just aft of the second funnel. So, answers on the back of a postcard. What used to be here? Was it a gun? Was it a torpedo launcher? Was it a sensor system? Well, of course, I know the answer, but, you know, it's fun to mention in the comments.
And that wraps up our tour of some of the upper deck features of USS The Sullivans. Once again, thank you very much to Buffalo Naval Park for letting me aboard the Sullivan so soon after her salvage. And if you want to go and see it, well, obviously, she's in Buffalo Naval Park along with USS Little Rock and USS Croker in upstate New York on the northwestern end. And if you'd like to see a little bit more of the Sullivans, there's a few additional clips from my visit there available over on the Drakenerfeld Patreon, including a 10-minute walk around of the upper decks, all done as one continuous take. That's something new which I'm bringing over to Patreon, basically the little behind-the-scenes clips and so forth that don't make it into the main videos in public. But in any case, thank you very much for watching, and see you again in another video soon.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.